This is KCUR Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Gina Kaufman. It has been a beautiful weekend. Abundant sunshine, hot weather, and for the kids among us, the end, or at least almost the end, of the school year. For a lot of us, that means it's time to find a pool or a lake or a splash park and cool off by getting wet. But for many, that has meant a turn to one of the most anxious parts of swim season, what to wear. Kate Warfield could help you, although more so if you were going swimming in 1904. Good morning, Kate.
Good morning.
Kate, you are a collection specialist at the Kansas City Museum at the Historic Garment District,
the Garment Museum.
You've curated this new exhibit of swimwear through the ages, all of it part of your collection. So presumably it was worn here in Kansas City. Let me start with this. What is your favorite piece in the exhibit?
It's hard to pick a favorite child.
And that's how you think of these pieces. All right.
If I was pushed to pick a favorite, we have a piece on exhibit from the late 40s that was made in Hawaii. It's a swimsuit, but the shape of it is more like what we would call a romper today.
Oh.
It's shorts. It's got a little halter top with it. And the best part, it has a matching beach jacket cover-up.
Hmm.
And it's got this really cool kind of tropical Hawaiian print on it, and it's this really neat kind of two-piece cover-up romper swimsuit set.
It sounds very like the movies of the beach blanket bingo sort of look.
That's so funny. Yes, it's exactly like that. It's very classic.
Well, of course, an exhibit on swimwear isn't just about classic fashions. It also tells us something about the tastes and the cultural sensitivities of different periods in our history, maybe even how we feel about our bodies. And so maybe we could start, Kate, by having you take us back to the beginning of the collection. Where does this start?
The earliest piece we have on exhibit for this show is from about 1904. It's a full women's one-piece swimsuit. It does not look like what we were to traditionally think of a swimsuit today.
So when we say a one-piece swimsuit, we have a certain image in our mind, but that's not this.
It's not, no. This has full coverage. It's got a skirt. It's got attached shorts underneath the skirt. It goes down to your knees. It has stockings that go with it and matching boots.
Which begs the question, could a person actually swim in this swimsuit?
Well, you know, in 1904, women didn't, quote-unquote, swim. They just essentially waded into the water.
Okay.
It was very fashion-forward in 1904 to wade into the water in a swimsuit.
Huh.
And this one, the swimsuit that we have, this 1904 one, is pretty unique in that it was donated to us with a set of water wings from 1904, which are a canvas bag that you can inflate and kind of wedge under your arms and around your chest and float away.
So not so different from kids' water wings today, except it's made of canvas.
Yeah, so it's a very tightly woven canvas, and when it's inflated with water, or excuse me, when it's inflated with air, it becomes almost impermeable. So it will stay, it'll stay, you know, inflated, and you can wade relatively easily with it. It was patented in 1904. The patent with it has this goofy little drawing of a person swimming with this water wing thing on.
Wow. So these materials you're talking about, wool and canvas even, for these are not things we think of as swimsuit material, but not uncommon at all in the early years.
Right. If you think about the types of swimsuit material we have today, it's nylon and lycra and spandex, and these are all relatively modern inventions in fiber. At the beginning of the 20th century, obviously there wasn't nylon and lycra and spandex, and so they gravitated toward the types of material that was used for outdoor activities, which more often than not was wool. And we think about a swimsuit being made of wool, and that sounds very uncomfortable, but if you kind of compare it to what other fibers were available at the beginning of the 20th century, wool was kind of your best option.
Like cotton, linen, I guess.
Right. Linen and cotton absorb water, and natural wool has a oil in it called lanolin, and that repels water.
Okay.
So it's going to dry a little faster than cotton or linen. It's not going to get as heavy when you wear it in the water as cotton or linen, because it will kind of beat up water a little better than other fibers will. It's very sturdy. You can do a lot of, like, exercise in wool.
It does seem itchy.
You know, I think today we don't wear wool every day. I think in 1904, more often than not, you probably had a piece of wool on every day. And so it's just kind of what you're used to and kind of what you're situated with.
So you have a lot of these samples from that period of history, right? From the early 1900s up through, say, World War II. And modesty is sort of the theme of the day, right?
Yes. The kind of a funny piece we have on exhibit was donated to us relatively recently. It was worn in about 1915 by a woman who bought it on her honeymoon in California.
Okay.
It's a very large blousey pant romper suit. So it's got long sleeves down to the elbows. It goes down to your knees, and it's made of linen, funny enough. When she donated it, she told us that she felt so risque when she wore it because it was so much different than what she was normally wearing. And swimwear has always kind of had this idea of bearing yourself to out in public, and how much modesty can you disregard when you're out in public, and how much you need to keep when you're out in public. So through the exhibit, you can kind of see the evolution of what people thought was okay to wear in public as the century wore on.
And yet, even the things that look to us very, very modest now might have seemed at the time to be really pushing the limits.
Right. It's again, it depends on what you wear every day and how much your swimwear differs from your daily uniform. And so it seems a little off kilter to us. But I think that's part of what makes the exhibit so interesting, is to be able to see what people were wearing and kind of relate it back to my own life or back to your life of how would I feel in that piece, or gosh, this is so interesting, I wonder how she felt when she wore that piece.
Mm-hmm.
We have kind of, part of the exhibit isn't just swimwear, it's summer fashions and specifically like beach related fashions.
Sure.
So we do have some what I'm going to call beach pajamas in the exhibit.
And beach pajamas. So you're going to have to describe that for us.
So a beach pajama is what we would call a jumpsuit today. And it was invented in the late 20s, and it became wildly popular in the 1930s. But it was one of the very first ways that women could wear pants in public. And they're big, what we would call like palazzo-type pants today. So they're very big and blousy. And when you walk, it looks like you're wearing a dress. It's very elegant. But it's also very risque. You know, in the 1930s, to wear a pair of pants in public is kind of...
Yeah. Even though it covers up more, in theory, it still was sending a message about something.
It does, yeah. And there's these really great photos of women in the 1930s wearing beach pajamas. And they look so happy together.
Huh.
And it's like they did it as a group outing, and you can tell by their expressions that they thought they were almost getting away with something when they wore these.
We're talking with Kate Warfield. She's at the Kansas City Museum at the Historic Garment District that has an exhibition called Diving In, 100 Years of Swim Fashion. And that's going to be on display all summer long. That's at 800 Broadway Boulevard. Kate, you are... You're talking mostly about women's fashions, but of course you have men's swimsuits in this collection as well.
We do. It's so funny. The 1920s pieces, we have a little tableau of 1920s swimwear, and we've got both men's and women's out in that section, and they look strikingly similar.
Which is really interesting, right?
Yeah, and it's not what we typically think of as gendered bathing suits today. They're essentially...
Strikingly similar in that they're both one-piece suits, right?
Yeah, they're one-piece, they have shorts, they have attached skirts, they're tank-top-style tops, and so they're sleeveless at least, which is different than swimsuits before that.
Mm-hmm.
In the 1920s, kind of the idea for swimming was to swim for health. And, you know, in the 1920s, people were trying to have progressive ideas about what health means. And it's there was a fairly famous woman swimmer who advocated for swimsuits for women that were actually usable and you could traditionally swim in them. And so swimsuits in the 1920s became these like knit wool jumpers with shorts and skirts that you could actually physically swim in. And it's pretty interesting.
Yeah, because it seems like that would be quite hindering.
Compared to the ones that we have on exhibit in the decade before, they are freeing.
Yeah, I suppose that's right. So is there a moment where swimwear took a turn toward the modern, what we now would think of as a more modern looking swimsuit?
I would say absolutely. And that moment came in the late 40s when the bikini was introduced.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, we actually don't have a bikini in the collection, so we didn't include one in the exhibit. We talk about the bikini, but you can kind of see in the exhibit after the bikini is invented, you can see swimwear start to trend toward that type of shape. It took a long time for the bikini to catch on because it's very different than what came before it. But you can start seeing...
I mean, it would be scandalous, wouldn't it, compared to the prior generation of swimwear?
Do you know what's so funny? This morning, just to refresh my memory on bikinis, the gentleman who invented the bikini in the late 40s couldn't find a model to wear his suit in a runway show.
Mm-hmm.
And so we hired a burlesque dancer to model his bikini.
Because no one else would do it.
Because no one else would put it on.
Wow. I mean, I have to think that the evolution of swim fashion is sort of in that direction, right? Of showing more and more flesh, essentially.
It is. And you can kind of see it through the end of the 20th century when kind of ideas about social status changed. You know, at the beginning of the 20th century, to have tanned skin showed that you worked outside and you had a job that was heavy labor. And so rich people would try and keep as, you know, covered up and pale as they could. So they told the other people that saw them that they didn't have a manual labor job. And so swimsuits covered everything. You know,
so you would not get tan.
Right. And so after the bikini was introduced and it became fashionable to have a tan and to go on vacation to these tropical paradises like Hawaii, you can kind of see swimsuits start to trend towards smaller and smaller so you could encourage that tan. But now in 2019, I think people are starting to realize kind of what people realized 100 years ago, that if you have too much sun on your skin, you can get very sick. And so now I think swimsuits are kind of trending toward a little bit more cover up and rash guards and we're back into the health model.
Yeah. How interesting. Everything is cyclical.
Fashion is always cyclical. Just hold on to your things to the 1980s. They'll be popular again in 10 years.
I don't know about the 1904 bathing costume, whether that's ever really coming back. I want to ask you about this collection just in general. We can talk more about the swimsuits in a minute. But how does it happen that the Kansas City Museum comes to even have a collection of swimwear? Because everything you're showing is something that you've had in the collection.
It's from the collection. Yeah. So the Kansas City Museum has been a collecting institution since 1940, and we're still a collecting institution. So if you have one of those bikinis for the 1940s that has a Kansas City connection, I'm interested.
You can be a donor to the Kansas City Museum.
So the museum has collected Kansas City's history since 1940, and our task is to help Kansas City understand our history and what used to happen in the city, and kind of our cultural heritage, and how 2019 can relate to 1919. We have a relatively large clothing and textile collection, probably one of the largest in the Midwest. Kind of the cool thing with this exhibit is most of the pieces we have in the swimwear exhibit have never been on exhibit before. And that's always really exciting to us to be able to put something fresh out that people haven't seen, and kind of help flesh out a story that hasn't been told before.
Flesh out, if you will. were any of these swimsuits worn by famous people?
Not unless you count everyday Kansas Cityans as famous.
Well, that's a good point. And actually, I want to ask about that. This is a Kansas City museum, and these are Kansas City swimsuits. Now, I love Kansas City, but I'm not sure I've ever thought of, in my 20 years living here, I've not really loved it because of its fashion forwardness. I mean, do they reflect a particular Midwestern culture of swimwear?
I would say yes, probably. It's the earlier pieces we have on exhibit were a good portion of them were made in California, and they were purchased when the Kansas Cityans went on vacation to California.
Right.
And so I think that kind of says something about what Kansas City was doing here in 1910. But then as the exhibit progresses in time, we do, funny enough, have a few pieces that were made in Kansas City in the garment district. Kansas City used to have one of the country's largest ready-to-wear, so it was never couture. It was one of the country's largest ready-to-wear garment industries, and they were, you know, clothing Kansas City and clothing the Midwest, and so we've got a pair of beach pajamas that were made here in Kansas City, and we also have a 1970s one-piece traditional-style bathing suit that was made here in the Garment District, which is relatively unique. I don't think a whole lot of them were made in the district, but it kind of helps tell that story.
Yeah. I'm told that you have some swimming trunks in this exhibit that are made out of disposable paper. I don't understand.
We do. We've got a pair of men's trunks of the 1960s that, lucky for us, came with their original packaging, so they were never worn. Mm. But they're made out of
if they were worn, you wouldn't have them, right?
Right, yes, exactly. But they're made out of paper, and so the idea is, you know, if you got yourself into a pinch and you needed a pair of swim trunks, or you forgot them when you were on vacation, I don't know why mm-hmm. you wouldn't have them. You could go down to the corner store and buy a relatively inexpensive, disposable set of men's Tyvek trunks.
I don't understand how this works. It seems like of all the pieces of clothing that one would not want to be something that could disintegrate
dispose,
in water.
I know, yeah. It's apparently in like college swim meets, at least in the 1990s, swimmers were still wearing Tyvek trunks. I'm assuming they're still doing that today. Hmm. Someone told me, who was a swimmer in college on the college swim team, at the end of your swim season, the last few races are the ones that you want to do your very best at. They're the ones you've been training for all year. And so you'll work up to wearing a Tyvek Speedo because it'll help your aerodynamics in the water more than like a nylon one will.
Huh.
And so it's kind of the same idea in the 1960s. It's paper. It won't last very long. The person that told me they wore them in college said you only have about three races before they start to fall apart.
I would think you would want to, maybe you'd want to swim more quickly.
Right. Yeah. Maybe. I don't know.
I'm also curious. Certainly, the museum can cover a lot, can bring presentations about a lot of things. Why swimwear? What is it about this topic in particular that got your attention?
Well, we haven't done it before. And I think it's kind of a fresh story that hasn't been told yet. We have some really great swimsuit pieces in the collection that, you know, we always try and use the bulk of our collection to its greatest ability. And so to be able to put all these pieces that haven't been exhibited before together, we thought it'd be really fun. Summer is here, kind of telling the Kansas City story in the summer of the summer. It's kind of fun and fresh and a little bit relaxing. The last exhibit we did was couture gowns, so this is a drastic change from that.
Yeah. One of the things that there's been some coverage about in the early years, maybe the 1920s and 30s, is that swimming often was something done in single-gender groups and
yeah.
without any swimsuits at all.
Right.
There was a story some years ago about how the Chicago public schools were required boys to swim nude well into mm-hmm. the 60s and 70s.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, where is the line between and part of the reason for that, according to something I read, was that the fibers of those early swimsuits originally would get caught in the filtration systems of pools like
sure.
wool and cotton.
Sure.
How did the change in fabrics also affect people's the things people chose to wear? I mean, what fabrics are being used after the 40s and 50s when you said this turning point came?
Yeah. So before that, you know, before the 40s and 50s, it was mostly wool because it's a durable sports material, but technological advances in manufacturing made other fibers much more accessible and much cheaper than they could have been earlier. And, you know, kind of this idea of how much clothing one person owns has drastically changed over time as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at the beginning of the 20th century, an average Kansas Cityan would not have the closet that, let's say, I have today. And so you have to be a little bit more judgmental about the pieces that you purchase.
Right.
And the cost of those materials and the cost of the garments you own.
You probably only had one bathing suit.
Oh, most assuredly. Oh, my gosh. If you had any, you definitely had one. And as fibers became less expensive, as clothing became less expensive and more accessible, you see people start to collect closets like what we have today. And it took a long time for us to get to where we are today. But kind of after that bikini era started, you start seeing more and more swimsuits made out of cotton and elastic. Elastic became kind of more accessible after World War II. Everything kind of changed after World War II, just kind of across the board. And we see that in swimwear.
Well, I think this sounds like a fascinating exhibit. And it's running through September 21st at the Garment Museum at 8th and Broadway. It's $5 a person, but I'm sure well worth the cost. Kate Warfield is the curator of that exhibit. She's a collection specialist at the museum. And Kate, thank you so much for being here this morning.
Thank you for having me.
We need to take a break, but I imagine all this talk about swimwear has you wanting to lace up that bathing costume and take the plunge yourself. Coming up, we talk with a local woman who teaches kids to swim at the same pool where she took lessons when she was 18 months old. How to swim when KCUR Central Standard continues. In many families, swimming is a childhood activity taken for granted. Long days by the pool or trips to the lake where kids learn to splash and float and backstroke. But that's not true for every kid or every family. For some, learning to swim is a matter of finding somewhere to take lessons and mustering the courage to do it. This is KCUR Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Gina Kaufman. And with summer swimming season just getting underway, we're talking about how to swim. There's no better person, maybe in the whole city, that we could be talking with today than Danielle Randall. She's the aquatics director at the Lynnwood YMCA. Danielle, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
It's really nice to have you here. So how long have you been swimming yourself?
I've been swimming since I was about 5 years old. That's when I started competing, and I learned how to swim at the Lynnwood YMCA.
At the very place where you now work.
Yes.
How did you first start learning to swim?
So my mother actually put my brother into lessons. She realized that at a very young age, he had no such thing as fear. So she was like, at this point, I'm going to make sure that I get both of my kids into swimming lessons.
And so how old were you then when you really started learning?
18 months.
My 18 months.
Did the Mommy and Me classes. So at 18 months, and then I started competitively swimming at the age of 5.
So talk to me about an 18-month-old starting swim lessons, Mommy and Me. Like, what is that?
So Mommy and Me is really just getting them acclimated to the water so they can get used to it and just be comfortable in the water. So when they become of age, where they start to understand what it's like to be in the water, they won't understand fear. All they know that it's a fun place that they came with their parents before. And, you know, it's a good place where they're going to have a good time.
So you don't remember, of course, starting lessons at 18 months.
No, I don't.
What are your first memories since they were your parents worked hard to help you not be afraid of the water?
So honestly, my first memory is competition-wise. When I was in Atlanta, it was an all-black swim meet that I went to. And I know that I went there just going to compete. And my parents was telling me, Danielle, do you understand that you get swim with 12-year-olds and you're 10 years old and you basically get to beat everybody in the meet? And I was just so happy to just be there and see people who look like me swimming. So that's really my first memory of swimming.
So you teach classes at the Lynnwood Y. Obviously, there's lots of places with pools and places that kids learn around the city. But take us back to what it was like and compare it to how it is today at the Lynnwood Y.
How it is today is, I would say, more kids are eager to learn how to swim. You know, back in the day, I won't say that I remember, you know, people wanting to, but I can say today kids come up to me and they'll see me in my lessons and they'll actually imitate what I do. They won't necessarily interrupt, but they'll be next to us doing the exact same motions that I'm showing the kids who are in lessons. So I can say kids are way more eager to learn how to swim just so that they can be on the other side and just enjoy swimming without wearing a life jacket.
Right. Without people telling them where they can and can't go.
Yes. You know, kids nowadays do not want anybody telling them where they can and can't go. So.
Well, I've heard that kids even were like that even in the old days.
I'm pretty sure. Yeah.
you talked about going to Atlanta to this this all-black swim meet and how neat it was to actually see kids who look like you.
Yeah.
There's sort of this stereotype or maybe a perception that African Americans don't swim or don't like to swim or are afraid to swim. Can you talk about that? Is there any truth to that?
It's truth to just about everything that you hear. Yes, I wouldn't say that African American kids don't swim. It's that we might not swim during the winter time because we're just not used to having an indoor pool. Because Lynwood, we now have an indoor pool, so now we're able to swim year round, and we're getting more people to come and more people of color to come and swim and enjoy that time.
Why do you think historically there was any disparity at all? You mentioned the lack of an indoor pool being one thing. Was there a different attitude about swimming?
I don't think there was a different attitude. There could have been. You know, people could have been more afraid because growing up in our community, a lot of people didn't swim. Mm. So that did create that fear for most people. I get kids coming in from different backgrounds talking about how they're afraid to swim because their parents didn't learn how to swim. And now, since we have that indoor pool, they can come in and experience different things. And as my lifeguards are talking to them, they can just tell them about the fears that they won't be able to face here, because we make sure that it's a safe environment for everybody. And it's just somewhere that they can come and have fun.
It's pretty cool pool setup. I've seen pictures. I haven't been over there since the remodeling, but people can just wade in. It's pretty low risk if you're not sure about your swimming skills.
Yes.
Yet.
Yeah, we got a zero depth entry, and it's about 5 feet in the middle. Other than that, it's a really safe pool. It's a great pool for beginner swimmers, because like I said, it's a zero entry. You can take your time. You don't have to just worry about jumping in and not being able to feel the bottom of the pool with your feet.
That would help me, actually.
Yeah.
So let's talk practicalities. How old should kids be when they start lessons?
I'd say 3 years old, because they're able to walk and they're talking, and you know, it's best that we don't get too much talking from them, because I have a few kids who will try and talk the whole entire lesson. So 3 years old would be a good time to come in so they can understand, and, you know, to teach them about the permission to ask their parents to get into the water. Because at that age, they're just shaking their head yes, no. They're trying to understand what you're saying. And so just talking to them about the water safety aspects of it. And, you know, they start to understand and get the right thing in there.
Because if they're old enough to walk, they're old enough to accidentally fall into
yes,
a pool.
Yes.
Yeah. So you have classes for kids starting at 3 years old.
Yes.
And then how old can a person be and still take swimming lessons?
So I actually taught my first lesson with a 99-year-old man. So you can be
well,
any
age.
Yes, that's really old. The thing that he gets one to come and learn how to swim. So you can be any age. We have adults, 30, 40. It doesn't really matter your age. Whenever you want to come in and get those lessons, we're willing to teach you.
That was the first lesson you taught?
First lesson at the Swope Park Pool for Parks and Rec.
How old were you then?
I was 15.
Teaching a 99-year-old man
yeah.
how to swim. That's
yes.
pretty great.
It was amazing. I didn't know he was 99. He's just coming in, just, I'm ready to take my lessons. And I'm like, all right, sure.
So what should people expect if they're going to come or, you know, maybe bring their kids to take a lesson? How does it work? I think a lot of parents will be pretty nervous about sort of sending their kid off to the pool for the first time if they don't yet know how to swim.
So, yeah, they're coming in for lessons. We'll give them a welcome letter. We'll talk to them about it. And I'll also tell parents, I understand that you're excited for your kids, but at this moment, just like if you were at school and they're going to kindergarten for the first day, you're not going to go in there and tell the teacher, this is what I want you to teach my kid, you know. Or I just like for parents to sit back and watch. Make sure you're paying attention to your child just to see the progress that they're doing. And then once they leave, you can talk to them about it. And it's also a learning part for you as well. If you're not comfortable in the water, you now get to see how we take our lessons, how we introduce them to the water and things that you can learn about, and just water safety aspects of everything.
I'm guessing that kids who are nervous about learning to swim might be reflecting the fact that their parents are nervous.
Yes.
Yeah. How much does it cost for people to come take swim lessons?
So we have a different cost for non-members. It's about $75. For members, it can be as low as $40, depending on if you want to do group lessons or private lessons. But yeah, so we don't go over the 75 range. It just stays below that.
And that's for a certain number of lessons?
Yeah, so you can get 6 lessons for either $55 or $75, depending on if you are a member or a non-member. So that's 6 30-minute lessons. Or with the same price, you can get 4 45-minute sessions.
Yeah. Let's say the kid is still nervous about it. They're afraid. Maybe I'm projecting my own story. Let's just say. But, you know, when my parents brought me to the Y, which is where I also took swim lessons as a kid, what should they have been doing to help me be ready for that, to be more calm, to think it's going to be okay?
So we have different sources. You can, when you're at home, you know, in the bubble bath or things like that, just get used to blowing bubbles like that, getting used to submerging their face in the water and being comfortable and just staying calm. Also, there are different books out there that they can read, or just going online and just looking at different things. You know, the best source is Google. You can Google anything, and that's one thing that I would say. Or if they have any questions, you know, you can always contact us before the lessons come, and we can give them paperwork on, you know, prerequisites and just small tips and things like that.
Sure. Can you think of a particular kid or adult that you've worked with who really overcame fear to learn to swim?
Yes. I'm not going to say her name, but this is a young lady who I was working with. She was super nervous, and I said, "Why are you so afraid?" She said, "I don't want to drown." And I told her, I said, "Who do you live with?" She said, "My mom and brothers and sisters and dad." I said, "Well, my main thing is to get you back home so that you can tell your parents and your brothers and sisters how much you enjoy swim lessons today. I want to make sure that you're comfortable. My main goal is to get you home. And, you know, and I want you to be just so fearful of the water that you're not able to do anything. You know, Operation Breakthrough is paying for your lessons so that you can learn how to swim. So we're going to do them a favor, and we're going to teach you how to swim so that you can go back and tell your family and friends how much fun you had here at the Y."
So if a person can't swim but still wants to be around the water, are there some safety tips that you can give to people who just want to make sure they're safe when they're going to be near a pool or near the ocean or a lake or something?
Yeah, so one thing I will always put out there is if you see someone who is in help, I would say reach, throw, do not go. Our reach, throw, do not go is if there is a stick, a shirt, a towel, or anything that's next to you and someone needs help, throw that object out there. The reason why you do not want to jump into the water is because you might have on heavy material. Your clothing can, it won't be the best for you, you know. So that person's already fearful of their life, and then you come over, and if you're not trained, they will push you down and do anything to keep themselves above water. And another thing I would tell them is always make sure that you have a life jacket. If you wear a life jacket, make sure it's Coast Guard approved. The floaties that you guys wear on your arms, those aren't the best. Mm. So always make sure anything that you use is Coast Guard approved. And also, if you go swimming or if you're with a group of friends, make sure you tell an adult. Let someone know where you're going in case anything does happen. At least someone is accountable for your location.
I know there are some adults listening who are embarrassed to admit they can't swim, and I think it's a different set of considerations for adults than it is for just parents of children. Mm-hmm. What's your encouragement to them? Obviously, just like learning anything, it sometimes is a little harder when you're an adult. What do you say to those adults?
I would say just take a chance. You know, if you don't know how to swim, just come on down to the Y. You're not the only adult who doesn't know how to swim. Whatever your profession is, I'm pretty sure if I went into your profession, I'm trying to learn something, I'm not going to get it the first day. It may take me several times to understand it, asking you questions, just trying to get acclimated with your position. So get acclimated with my position. Just try to see what it's like to learn how to swim. You know, just take it step by step. Like infants, you don't just start walking immediately. You learn how to crawl, and then you start to walk. So we'll learn how to crawl, and then we'll learn how to swim, and it'll make everything much better for you.
So besides the Linwood Y, where you work, where else can people swim in this city? Where are places that are good to go and play around, experiment with it, and maybe even take some lessons?
We have Brush Creek, like I said, Swole Park, the Gregg Center, Tony and Gary.
So YMCA locations and maybe even a few other community
pools.
So,
I'm just naming the ones that's around my community. And then we have Overland Park. We have Atchison, Kansas, North Kansas City. North Kansas City is one of the most inclusive Ys. You know, everybody of all backgrounds is able to go there, and we have a great facility up there, and, you know, just all around the city.
All right. Well, so my last question for you is why do you do this, Danielle? You obviously could be doing a lot of things.
Yeah.
You seem like you really love this job, though. How come?
Yes, I'm just so passionate about the water. Like, I left to go play college basketball, and then I came back to Kansas City, and I was like, what am I going to do with my life? And then this position opened up at the very place where I learned how to swim. And then I just realized everybody may not pick up a basketball or be a singer or a dancer, but every child is going to learn or is going to go to the pool. And I want to make sure that I can, you know, just provide that safety aspect for my community, teach kids how to swim, and just make it enjoyable for them when they come to the pool, and just eradicate the fear of not knowing how to swim and just be fearful of the water. I just want to make sure that my community is able to have fun wherever they go swimming at, and just know that it's a great thing to do. And it's very therapeutic. When you go to the pool, it's like it's the best. It's the best feeling. You just know that you're out there relaxing, getting a nice tan, and it's a good place to meet people. So,
well, maybe I'll have to give it a shot. Yeah. It's Danielle Randall. She's aquatics director at the Lynnwood YMCA. Thank you so much for taking a few minutes with us today.
Thank you for having me today.
We need to take a quick break, but we will turn from youth swimming to another group making a splash. It's a rock orchestra, a group of musicians of diverse talents and ages and cultures and record labels with just one thing in common. They're all women. We'll hear about their experiences and their upcoming performance when KCUR Central Standard returns. A woman in a black dress takes the stage at the Blue Note in Columbia. It's a cover, of course, of the song that Aretha Franklin made famous. The camera pans across the band and picks up something unusual. The drummer, the lead guitarist, the trombone players, the trumpeters, they're all women. The strings, the sax, the keys, all women. It's the Jane Doe Revue, an all-female rock band bringing together women and girls from across Missouri. The Jane Doe Revue is coming to Kansas City this weekend, 18th and Vine, with more of their classic covers and an unmistakable sound. Violet Vonderhaar is the founder of the Jane Doe Revue, and she's with us, joining us by phone from Columbia this morning. Violet, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Really, really interested in knowing more about the Jane Doe Revue. It's just 2 years old. How did this get started?
Well, the Jane Doe Revue started in 2017, partly as a reaction to the Women's March and that just incredible, powerful feminine energy that just kind of took over the whole globe that day and I think sparked a lot of really amazing projects since then. But it just happened one night, my partner and I, Phil Sean, who plays drums in our band, we were kind of going back through history, listening to our favorite songs that we grew up listening to, and it kind of just came up. I think we just randomly were like, man, we should cover all these songs. And then we were like, well, what if we just got all the women we know and put, you know, invited them to do this with us? And so that's what we did. So we asked every female musician that we knew in Columbia pretty much and pieced all the pieces together. And pretty much every single person we asked that first year, they said yes, they were all in. And it's blossomed since then.
Now these are all women musicians who have other lives as musicians and maybe doing other things too. How did you manage to pull them together for another separate musical commitment?
Magic.
Sounds like it.
It just happens every year. It's just you know, I think because the first year it was a benefit for Planned Parenthood Great Plains. And I think because of that, with it being a volunteer band and there being this greater sense of purpose behind the project, you know, it's more, of course, we're making music together and that's in itself is really powerful. But we're also coming together with this common cause of, you know, standing up for women's rights and for raising money for women right here in Missouri. So our first year, we did a benefit for Planned Parenthood. And then last year in our Columbia show, we benefited the National Organization for Women, our Columbia chapter. And we took the show also to Kansas City last year for the first time. And we collaborated with Planned Parenthood Great Plains for that with an event called Pink Out. And then our last show we did in November, which was just unreal. We had the opportunity of playing at the Uptown Theater with Gloria Steinem with an event that Planned Parenthood also put together. So those were our first few shows, and then this year for Kansas City, we're benefiting Midwest Music Foundation, and in Columbia, we're benefiting a domestic violence and crisis intervention center based in Moberly called Safe Passage.
Well, let's talk about the event. It's coming up on Saturday night here in Kansas City, as I understand it, June 8th. Doors open at 7:30, shows at 8. What should folks expect?
Well, we start in the current decade, so we pick five songs from each decade, and we start in the current decade and make our way back to the 60s. So it's this fun walk through time. It's five hits from each era. So a lot of times, you know, as we move back through time, the songs start getting a little bit more familiar with our older crowds. There's more singing along, but it's a great big party. You know, we get together and we just sing all these songs that, you know, everybody loves and recognizes. And so that's what you should expect as far as the performance goes.
I don't know if that's the only reason there's more singing along as the night goes on.
Right. Right. There will be drinks, yes.
Well, I mean, tell me more about who's in this band. From the videos online I've seen of the earlier concert, it looks like a pretty eclectic group.
Yes. So the number fluctuates.
Okay.
But I'm pretty sure we're up to about 43 women that are involved in this project, and that's spanning the Columbia and Kansas City show. Our backing band is about 23 women. We've got a full string section, horn section. We've got two drum sets on stage. We've got a keyboard section and guitar players and bass players. And then our soloists are rotating casts, a rotating cast of members from the community. So as far as Kansas City goes, some of our some of the guest soloists that will be participating are Mikal Shapiro, Casey Roush, Terry Quinn, Blue False Indigo, Amy Farron, Ivy Roots. Who else am I missing? That's a big group there. But so those are the soloists that will be singing for us.
The age of the women in the band covers a pretty wide range too, it looked like.
Yes, yeah. So especially in our Columbia show, we've got two young girls that are actually my students. I teach during the week, and so their age is eight years old. All the way up to this year, I believe our oldest will be 71 years old.
Wow.
So it definitely covers a whole span. And like you mentioned earlier, a lot of us are full-time musicians, but a lot of us aren't. A lot of us, for some of the women, it's their first time on a stage. You know, especially that first year for a lot of these women, it's a pretty life-changing experience.
Well, you would never know that from the sound. It seems like a pretty professional bunch.
Thank you.
Particularly given that, as it sounds like, you only perform together, a couple times a year at most.
Right.
How do you even rehearse?
Again, I think it's magic. But no, we have three rehearsals and leading up to the show, because of the amount of people involved. That's about all we can really fit in as far as our schedule goes.
Because a lot of you're not all from Columbia, right?
Right. Yeah. So we've got members from Springfield, Kansas City, Columbia, St. Louis, and North Carolina this year.
Wow.
And so, yeah. So definitely covers the span, and I think we've got a few other sprinkled in the Midwest area. It's hard to even keep it all track since there's so many of us, but. But yeah, so we set the dates for the rehearsal months ago, and we rehearse on Sundays. And yesterday was our marathon rehearsal. We started at 12:30 in the afternoon and didn't finish until about 6 o'clock. So that was quite the marathon, but we made it through.
So how did you get the name Jane Doe Review?
Well, we wanted a name that could really encompass any woman, you know, that could be anybody under that umbrella. And a Jane Doe is any woman, is me, it is you, it's any culture, any age, affiliation. And we just felt like that one fit. And of course, with Review, we are a big band, so we are a Review.
Yeah. I guess I'm curious. I mean, obviously the group is all women. How does that change the experience for you as musicians? Most of you have played in other bands, or you do play in other bands. Some, I'm sure many of you play with men with some regularity. How mm-hmm. is this different?
Well, you know, when we first started the project, so my main project is a band called Violet and the Undercurrents, and we are an all-female band, and we've been around for about 8 years now. We've always had only women in the band. So for me, it was always it's very natural for me to be in a space full of women making music. But that was one something I didn't necessarily anticipate. I think of that first year was a lot of these women walking into this space. It was their first time in a room full of women making music. Hmm. And for some of them, it was their first time making music with women in general. Like, some of them maybe had never even done that before. And so it was really eye-opening for a lot of them. I've heard from several of them say that it's completely changed their perspective and the way that they hold themselves when they are in a space with men making music. But it's a really empowering and inspiring feeling just to have that that community of these players behind you, and we're all in it together. And it's you know, there's this sense of, I think partially a big reason for it, because it's a benefit band. You know, we're part of it. We're coming together for this kind of this greater good. So a lot of the ego has to be let go. You know, I've heard from so many of the women, and they're like, I don't even care if I get a solo. I just want to be involved. I'll sing backup. Somebody else can take a solo. So it's about supporting each other and lifting each other up. It's not about, you know, trying to be front and center. We're all taking our turns to have a highlight in the group. And so I just love that aspect of it, that you know, we're all, it's a community.
Yeah.
It's a community, and we support each other.
Do you think it affects the music itself?
Oh, absolutely. Oh yeah. I mean, just in our rehearsal yesterday, it was, there were tears. There were tears in rehearsal. We're already making ourselves cry. Yeah, absolutely.
I know this is a benefit for the Midwest Music Foundation, specifically Abby's Fund. Can you talk about what that is?
Sure. So the Midwest Music Foundation is an organization that benefits musicians' healthcare, or healthcare for musicians. And Abby's Fund is the fund that provides the financial assistance for musicians. So if you have a last minute emergency, medical emergency, and you're unable to cover your expenses, you can apply for a grant through the Midwest Music Foundation. And most often they will provide you an assistance, financial assistance, sometimes within a week or so. Their turnaround time for their grants are very short. They try to make the process as easy as possible. And it's an amazing organization that I'm really excited to be able to be working with them, because what they're doing is just really important and very appreciated.
The concert, we should say, is at the Record Bar on Saturday night. I see the concert will also include ASL performers, sign language interpreters.
Yes.
Has that always been part of your concerts?
Yes. Yeah. Sarah Newman Henley and Dana Bucky are our ASL interpreters, and they're just performers, I should say, ASL performers. They've been a part of the project since the beginning. And, you know, we try to make this project as inclusive as possible. We want everybody there, everybody and anybody who wants to be there and be moved by the power of music and of women coming together and making magic.
What's been the greatest moment you've had with this group, would you say? Tough question, I know.
Probably. I mean, there's been so many. I mean, every single show has just been so powerful, but I'd have to say that getting to have a one-on-one meet and greet with Gloria Steinem, that might be the top.
Kind of a highlight.
It was so amazing. Oh my gosh! I mean, she stood at the door, and she hugged every single woman in our band, and she took the moment to say hello and thank you to every single one of us. And it was just, oh man, to be in her presence was just, it was life-changing. It was powerful.
Yeah. Would you want this thing to get bigger? Would you want this band to be able to perform, this orchestra to perform more together? Or is it what it needs to be right now?
You know, that's a good question. Because it is a lot of work. Well, you know, I start curating the set list in November. So it's definitely a year-long process. But one of my visions is for Jane to Review to be this establishment that other groups can start in other cities, you know, or maybe it's not necessarily the players that are in this band, but it's just a group where women can come together and have that umbrella term. And actually, one of our goals too, we were hoping to make that happen this year, but it unfortunately didn't. But our plan is to tour more throughout Missouri, so bring the show to St. Louis, maybe bring the show down to Springfield.
All right. Well, we'll be watching to see if it can happen. We're going out with music from the Jane Doe Review. That's Violet Vonderhaar, the founder. They're performing Saturday night at 8 o'clock at the Record Bar. Hope folks will go and see it. Thanks so much for being with us, Violet.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for having me.
We really appreciate it. If you missed our conversations today about swimming or swim lessons or swimwear, you can find them all later today at kcur.org/centralstandard. In fact, you can find all our shows there or get them as a podcast, kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, political internships. That's at 10 a.m. The show's produced by Melody Rowell, Chris Young, Suzanne Hogan, and Salisa Kalakal. Our intern is Riley Kester. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Brian Ellison. Have a great day. Up to Date is coming up next.